Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 570th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also an adjunct professor at the University of Alberta.
And Mike, I know you'd agree that our last two podcasts were scintillating, like edge of your seat stuff.
Well, you know, I was thinking, could they replace Z drugs as both potentially impacting cognitive ability the following day, but also helping people fall asleep? I'm not sure which one.
No, they could do that, but you got to add in, it also makes them addictive.
Yeah, that's right. And it's, to punishing levels of information about statistical significance.
Yeah, so if people are only just tuning into this one, you're wondering what the hell's going on. But in the previous two podcasts, we've been trying to talk a way about how to think about statistics. And we talked a little bit about descriptive statistics, which was just, you know, if you're 100,000 people vote, this many people voted for this person and a bunch voted for this other person. That's descriptive statistics. But most of what we see in clinical trials and where it gets a bit more nuanced is talking about inferential statistics. And in the last podcast, we talked about p-values. We talked a little bit about 95% confidence intervals. And what we thought we'd do, hopefully in the last one of this series,
you never know. The last one before we move on to the other seven.
Yeah, exactly. is to go over just the results of a trial and then a little bit of a discussion about a paper that Mike and I wrote with a co-colleague, and we'll talk about that in a bit. But just to go over how we think of the numbers and how we sort of interpret them. And what we do is we take what we know about statistics and then just add a little bit of, you got to do something.
Yeah, you got to make up your mind sooner or later.
Yeah. So one of the best examples I've always used, and I've used this with lots of medical students and pharmacy students and in general, lots of people, is the 2000 HOPE trial. And if any of you remember what that was, it was the big trial that came out, and it's the reason why we all use Ramipril for, I think, everything, including pneumonia. That's an exaggeration. But what it was the key trial that looked at Ramipril versus placebo in higher cardiovascular risk patients. And they looked to see if Ramipril did anything to cardiovascular events. It doesn't matter how the trial was put together or designed. That's not the important thing. But the main result that was presented was, overall, there was a cardiovascular event that occurred in 17.8% of the placebo group. But let's round it up to 18. And 14% in the Ramipril group. So 18 in the placebo group had a cardiovascular event, 14 in the Ramipril group. And the point estimate for this outcome, and we talked about that in the previous podcast, was reported as a relative risk of 0.78. And we'll get into what that means in a minute. There was a p-value of less than 0.001. And the 95% confidence interval was between 0.7 and 0.86. And if you're following along, the point estimate, 0.78, is kind of right in between those two. So the question is what do those numbers mean? Because we, Mike, you know, we use those numbers all the time to try and give you an idea of the benefit.
We use these exact numbers.
Yeah. No, exactly.
we talk about confidence intervals and p-values all the time to talk about. Well, really, we're using, as you've gone over before, the inferential statistics to imply that we think. In most of these cases, we're talking about RCTs and we're trying to imply causation and all that kind of stuff.
No, exactly.
This trial is a landmark trial. And it was one of the, if I'm not mistaken, one of the early ones to have a catchy name.
Yeah, and it's interesting. There was a big debate about, is it ethical to call a trial the HOPE trial? Because who would not want to be in the HOPE trial? And there never has been the hopeless trial.
I was going to say, there's probably less interest in the hopeless trial.
Yeah. But that's nothing to do with statistics. That's our next podcast series is on ethics. It'll be it'll be riveting as well.
Oh, wow. Yeah, for sure.
So I did tell you the p-value, but all we do is we just look at the we look at the confidence interval, because the confidence interval tells us a lot more. So the point estimate was 0.78, and there was a confidence interval around it of 0.7 to 0.86. We, by definition, if that confidence interval does not include one, we know that it's statistically significantly different, because if it was one, the risk ratio would be, I don't know, 18 over 18, which is one. So we know that it's statistically significantly different, whether or not we have a p-value, which is why we basically ignore p-values on a fairly regular basis. And then the point estimate, the point estimate was 0.78. That means we would say there was a 22% lower risk in the treatment group than in the placebo group. And so 14%, which is what it was in the Ramapro group, is about 22% or maybe a quarter off of the 18%. So that's where those numbers come. So roughly, there was a one quarter reduction in the risk of a cardiovascular event.
Yeah, one quarter meaning one, like, as you're saying, about a 20 to 25%, 25% relative reduction in your risk of cardiovascular disease. There is an interesting thing here that you don't see that often now. And that's, trials are designed to, they're designed by they're outcome driven, and they often end when they accumulate the right number of outcomes.
Right.
And they're pretty close to the margins. What I mean by that is they're often only going to just, the upper confidence interval is only just going to get below one, because they don't really want to have to follow more people for longer than they have to. It's just a, and it makes sense. These trials are very expensive.
Yeah. And then, you know, we could also get into the whole thing of, you know, early stopping and all that sort of stuff.
Oh,
But the issue here was the p-value is 0.001. So what that tells you is the chance of seeing a difference, if there was no difference, you know, if there was no bias or confounding, would be less than 0.1%. So that's why we describe this as, you know, you'll hear people say it's very statistically significant, which drives me nuts, you know.
Yep, that's the way we often think about this.
Yeah.
There is some logic to it, because, you know, it's a compromise here between saying something like that, and I acknowledge that even sounds silly rolling off the tongue. But on the other side, it's ridiculous that we go, oh, that's a 0.06, so obviously there's no difference there.
No, exactly. And it comes back to the, you know, the black and white, it is or it is not statistically significant. We talked about that in the previous podcast.
Yeah. Like, or a confidence interval that's, you know, 0.5 to 1.01. Well, the intervention didn't work. Really?
Yeah.
Probability is it works.
Yeah, exactly. So and then that's how we look at it from a statistical perspective, and we say it was statistically different. And then, you know, a reasonable way to interpret, and I'll mention Bayesian just at the very end for about 30 seconds, but a reasonable way to interpret this single confidence interval from a single trial is to say the relative benefit is likely somewhere in that confidence interval. And I can't give you a probability of what I mean by the word likely, because inferential statistics do not give you probabilities, but you would say it's somewhere between a 30% reduction, because of these, one side of the confidence interval was 0.7, and a 14% reduction, because the other side of the confidence interval was 0.86. And so that's where we sort of go, we think it's somewhere in between those sorts of things. And the way I think about it, Mike, and I'm sure you probably think about it somewhat as well, is I look at both of those and go, if both of those relative benefits would be clinically significant, then I would go, then I'm really comfortable that the drug did something.
Yeah, clinically meaningful, you know, to avoid the word significance, but you're completely right. And so we've said now that, well, it depends on where you sit on that fence, but if you're a believer that acetamide's effective, that's a 7% reduction. This is a 14, which is somewhere around what PCSK9s do. What the GLP-1s do, the SGLT-2s. So that's probably a reasonable benefit. And 30% is obviously what statins do in the better trials and things like that. So no, these are, that you're right, that's a way to think of the numbers. This will enrage you, James, so I'm going
to
say it.
Yeah, please do, as you tend to want to.
But some will say that it's kind of a bell curve, with the confidence intervals, the ends, meaning it's less probable there, but the point estimate is where the greatest probability lies.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know that. Not, yeah. Now I'll sign off the podcast.
Yeah, and please, yeah, please never darken my doorstep again. Because it's not a probability, but there is some truth to what you're saying. But why don't we leave it at that? Because when it doesn't really make any difference whatsoever.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't.
Yeah. And so then you have to interpret now, what do we think about the absolute benefit? So we know that the risk was 18% in the placebo group. And if we take the point estimate, that means is about it went the point estimate was about a 20 to 25% reduction. The difference was 18 versus 14%. So that's a 4% difference. Now, if it was as big as a 30% difference, instead of it being a 4% difference, it might have gone up to maybe 5.5%. Or if it was only a 15% reduction, maybe the difference was 2.5%. So again, I would also look at the absolute difference. So there's a 4% difference seen, but it could be as small as a 2.5% absolute difference and as large as about a 5.5. And again, just look at those numbers. And there is no, I don't know if that means this drug worked. What I do know is it's why we use Ramipril in, you know, gallons per bushel for everybody.
Yeah. Well, we did before.
Yeah. We're using it less now.
ACE inhibitors and ARBs came out, but this was a kind of a, what do you call it? A watershed moment, a turning point.
It was a landmark trial and it just
that really did change our thinking about, this drug and the drug class.
Yeah.
And it, you know, and you're right. Like what is the right amount? We're asked that kind of question all the time. Like what's a good number needed to treat? And we can throw out those numbers, but really it's not, they're at best educated estimates. That's actually probably the strongest you could go telling someone because what is the right amount? And you've seen this in your patients, everyone who's listening right now, you've seen it in your patients. You tell them, you know, a potential benefit. Let's talk about cardiovascular risk estimation. And you say, if you take a drug, it could reduce your chance of heart attack or stroke by 3%. And the next patient, you're telling them it's going to go from 30 to 20, so 10%. And the 10% person kind of rolls their eyes at you and say they're not interested. And the 3% says, sign me up.
Yeah.
And so we can kind of guess the best way I look at this kind of thing is it's often what in medicine would we generally recommend for patients? Mm-hmm. What is that number? So like for primary prevention, it's often a number needed to treat or absolute number needed to treat of 100 or an absolute benefit of 1%. That's kind of where we're starting to go, maybe it's worth it.
Yeah.
And I know that sounds crazy, but that's,
But I would say it's because we can't get much more. Like 4% in this study is one of the biggest ones you'll see because it was higher risk people, you know, longer and all that sort of stuff. So I think we sort of get a bit going, well, it, at least it's better than zero.
Yeah.
You know, when we go with one.
Well, in fact, that is what happens. And then when you go down to things like treating otitis media and then, you know, how many kids are better by day, I'm picking 7.
Yeah.
You know, when you get a number needed to treat of 5, well, that's probably worth it. For depression, needed to treat of 10, that's worth it. You know, so we throw out these numbers and that you gave the range here of 2.5 to 5.5. Yeah. I think most people would say that range is reasonable, but those numbers, as you aptly indicated, are based a lot on the fact that the baseline risk is high.
Yeah, yeah. And then, so it's just based on, I would take it if the drug had no side effects, didn't cost anything, and I didn't have to really think about taking it. Who wouldn't?
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, so that's that. So that's an example of a clinical trial and how I think most people who look at this sort of stuff look at these numbers. So from a statistical perspective. And then I thought we'd just quickly run through an article that Mike, you and I co-authored a number of years ago with Ben Vandermeer. And it was a study where we tried to show how people, when they look at confidence intervals, they get confused.
Right.
And go ahead.
I'll give a little bit of background, James, because this is an interesting story. We were traveling, we won't say where, to give some talks. And it was in a car with a number of people in it, very intelligent, respectable people, and the conversation shifted in EBM ways, as they often do when we're in cars. And one of the people in the car said, "Did you hear there's a new study showing that statins don't work?" And I kind of was perplexed by that. Mm-hmm. And I kind of made up my mind, when we get back to the hotel, I'm going to look up this study. And what it was a meta-analysis. And it just got me thinking about how with meta-analysis, you can change inclusion criteria, you can fixed effects, random effects, odds ratios, relative risks, and you can shift things so that sometimes the confidence intervals, especially if it's close, will cross the line of no effect or not. And it got me thinking about how confidence intervals actually give us a range of effect, as James mm-hmm. described earlier, and we continually turn them into yes or no answers.
Yeah. And that was the exact example we used was to show that point, because when our colleague said it didn't work, what they were probably talking about at the time was that in primary prevention, when statins were given to people, it didn't reduce mortality.
Well, this one was cardiovascular.
Oh, was it cardiovascular? Really,
yeah. And it was really around, it was mortality. Yeah. I am sorry. You're right. It was the outcome was mortality, but it was just the idea of that eking over the line of no effect back and forth.
Yeah. And there's always been a debate. Do statins reduce mortality in primary prevention or not? And at the time when we wrote this article, there were five different meta-analyses. And you can imagine they actually looked at many of the same studies, because that's what they should do, because they may have had some different criteria, but they ultimately end up looking at almost the same population of studies, if you will. And what was really interesting was three of them said, yes, statins do reduce mortality. And then two of them said, no, they don't reduce mortality. And what was fascinating, and I can't show the image because we're on an audio podcast, but the point estimates and the confidence intervals had huge overlaps between all of them. And because they were basically looking at exactly the same studies. And so actually what all of these studies were really showing were very similar results, but a couple of them just didn't quite get over that statistical threshold, where the other ones just did. And we're talking like in the two that got over that threshold, or the three that got over the threshold, the one edge of the confidence interval was 0.99. So instead of, one is a threshold, it just got in there. Another one was 0.99 and another one was 0.96. So they just got in. And then the two that didn't get in, the one side of the point estimate was 1.01. And every one of these authors wrote in their paper that if it didn't go over that threshold, it didn't work. But if it did, it did work. And that's where everyone got confused, because you've got five meta-analyses, three of them saying, yeah, it reduces mortality, and two saying it doesn't, when in fact they're all showing exactly the same results.
Yeah, they were. That's what blew me away, was to think about, just if you just focus on the results themselves, there is there's no debate about it, to my mind. They have all such similar results. And like you said, they're using mostly the same trials.
Yeah.
And the point estimates are very similar. And certainly the point estimates of any of these fall within the confidence intervals of all the others. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it's just saying that we've got the same answers. It's just how we're interpreting this kind of dogmatic interpretation of statistical significance, yeah, when really we should be looking at what these numbers are telling us.
So the point estimate on average for those was about a 10% relative benefit, but all we could say is it probably reduces mortality. And I'm not using the word probable with a probabilistic thing, but it probably reduces mortality, but it could be a really small difference.
Well, that's the thing, right? Yeah. These drugs were being encouraged because of their reduction in more common outcomes, which is heart attack and stroke. And it was working to reduce those cardiovascular endpoints, that pooled cardiovascular endpoint. So the question was, though, but does it change mortality? And that's a tricky thing in all of these.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I would say a stroke or a heart attack is still an important outcome, whether you live or die.
Right.
But there's so many things that go into death as an outcome, car accidents. It could be cancer deaths. It could be a death from literally any other cause. And to pool it in, of course, even if you have a relatively important benefit in cardiovascular reduction leading to a reduction in death, its overall effect on mortality is still relatively small.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think, you know, it's so important to sort of think about it that way. Again, and we're not saying, and none of this means the drug works or not. You know, it's we think it does roughly this, and this is with multiple trials. So it's not just a single trial where all bets are off, I think. You know, if you have just a trial,
a trial like HOPE, you know, we talked about that earlier, big trial, long trial, mm-hmm. more like ALHAT, you know, mm-hmm. you're going to go, okay, that's probably that those results are probably reliable, mm-hmm. but as the trials get smaller and shorter, they become less, and they're tinkered with, like we talked about earlier.
Exactly. And then, so the only other way is when you read papers that, you know, where the authors have screwed it up with the example that we just gave you in that paper that we wrote. But you've also heard, I'm sure you said, there's a trend towards a mortality benefit or something like that. And there literally is no such thing as a statistical trend, even though we use those words all the time. It allows, I think people want to say it because it's their bias. It's their subjectivity, and they want to report that that's the case.
I think you have to, like, it's a hard call. So these confidence intervals, some of them went over, you know, we talked about the ones going to
1.01.
But if you looked at the range of the confidence intervals, for example, one of them went 0.83 to 1.01. So if you were a guessing person, you would guess that likely there's this drug results in a reduction. Mm-hmm. Are we sure of it? No. Is there about a 5 or 6% probability these findings are false? What we're seeing is false? Yeah. But I remember a large, and you and I have been in rooms, James, where mm-hmm. statisticians have debated the interpretation of statistics.
Oh yeah. And some people think they should never be used ever again. And I don't think that's right either. And the reason we're doing this podcast is to say, you don't need to necessarily how to do them, but you need to know how to interpret them.
Yeah. And I think, so I can understand why people use the term
trends,
because they want to indicate that if you're a guessing person, you would say that something's here. But again, that, you know, just what you were saying earlier, like if this is one trial and there's a trend, it's just interesting to me.
Yeah, exactly.
If you've got 11 trials and 66,000 people, it's kind of like, yeah, that's probably what's happening. It's just the evidence are so rare, we can't. It's hard to show at this stage.
And then there was I don't know if I put this in the notes for you to see as well, Mike, but there was a group that looked at, I think, like 550,000 randomized controlled trials looking for the word sort of trend, you know, or looked at how did they discuss the results of stuff that was almost statistically significant. And some of the phrases they used were these. It was all but significant. And then there was another one. It tended to be significant. Another one was just failed to reach statistical significance. And then a couple that I liked were, it was practically significant. And then the last one, last phrase that was used was, it was significantly significant.
Oh, okay.
Mm. Yeah.
And then versus non-significantly significant.
I have no idea what it means. Anyway, we all write that way. And that's why, you know, I've given up reading clinical trials. I just go look at the results and then figure it out myself. So,
but years ago, we wrote a paper that tried to examine this, like how often authors misinterpreting or actually reporting, you know, results around statistical significance, but reflecting more what are the confidence intervals actually finding.
I was
surprised it was reasonable. Like the authors, they didn't always line up, but a number of authors, they're just trying to report their results without being, we, in the paper, we were asking, like, are they dichotomizing these as yes or no answers and that kind of thing versus reflecting more what the confidence intervals might be suggesting.
Right. Yeah, no, exactly.
And a number were actually reflecting.
Oh yeah. And they may be missing it. And when you say it doesn't work, you may be missing an important benefit.
That's the problem,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And we go in with an idea that, you know, there are statistical results where the point estimate is on the line of no effect and the confidence intervals are somewhat narrow around it. Glucosamine would be one, but there are lots. And those are very reassuring.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the time, the statistics that we get from studies, we really are left with a degree of uncertainty because if they, you know, even when they are statistically significant, if they're right up against the margins, it's just as you described, James. If you then go, okay, what if it was the lowest confidence interval and what if it was the highest?
Mm-hmm.
Are those meaningful for me? And that then actually adds even another layer over statistical significance, because if the confidence interval was 0.99,
mm-hmm.
then the absolute benefit is often far less than a fraction of a percent.
Yeah, no, exactly. So that's why you need to ignore p-values pretty much and just look at the confidence intervals and then use your judgment.
Yeah, that's what it boils down to.
Yeah.
So I can see why people say trend. We kind of roll our eyes a bit at it, but it's a quandary in a world where we don't have clear answers.
No, exactly. So just a couple of additional notes on confidence intervals. The width of the confidence interval very much depends to a large extent on how many people were in the experiment, as well as the event rate. So if either of those go up.
The events. So it's a very interesting thing that people think, well, they should add more. But if you don't get the events, adding more actually just increases the width of the confidence interval unless you.
No, exactly. Yeah, and Scott Garrison, our friend and colleague, showed us that.
Yeah. He's a pretty smart guy, James.
Well, I hope he's not listening.
Hopefully he's not listening.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, his wife is much more charming. She's the person who helped me write my nutrition book. So we'll just leave it at that. And then the more people we study, the tighter the confidence interval typically becomes, as long as you got the event rates, as is being said. And here's the way I always just think about it. Just one final thing on confidence interval. If you're studying 1,000 people, you're almost for sure looking for a small benefit.
Yeah.
1,000 plus people, you're looking for a small benefit. And the reason that I say that is because that is the way. If you're looking for a small benefit, you have to study thousands of people. So just because a trial is 1,000 people doesn't make it a good trial. It doesn't make it a bad one, but it doesn't make it a good trial. Because, and just very quickly, the example that I can give you is, I don't know if you knew this, Mike, but did you know general anesthesia works?
I've heard rumors.
Yeah. Yeah. So if I don't think we would ever do a placebo-controlled trial of general anesthesia. But if we were to do that, I think it's somewhat informative to know if, let's assume, I think general anesthesia works in everybody, and if you don't give them general anesthesia, they don't go to sleep. To actually show a statistical difference where the drug works in everybody, if you give it to them, and it doesn't work in anyone, if you don't give it to them, you need to study 4 people in each group. That's a total of 8 people. If you have a drug that really works and it's, you know, 4 go to sleep in one group and 0 go to sleep in the other group, that's statistically significantly different. That shows you that if a drug really works, you don't need a lot of people in a study.
Yeah. And you, after a while, you don't need statistics either.
No, you don't even need statistics. And in fact, you don't even need to do it. I would say general anesthesia falls under the all or none level of evidence, which is nobody just falls asleep.
Yeah. It's kind of like the idea of falling out of an aircraft. You don't,
exactly.
You don't need a randomized control trial to say that's bad.
Yeah. And so a couple of other examples of, you know, if you just go back to flipping coins, if you flip 400 coins, you will typically see a run of 9 in a row of either heads or tails. That's just the way it works. And you'll see 5 or more heads or 5 or more tails in a row. you know, anywhere from 6 to 12 times. And so when people say, oh, what's the chance of that happening? Well, if you do it enough, it's there.
It's not too bad.
Yeah.
What's interesting is we as humans, there's been research on this as well. We then start to assume patterns.
Yeah.
In those things, we start to assume that something is happening, that there's a pattern that exists here. So, and that pattern might be manifest as a simple belief that the very next toss after 5 heads has to be a tail.
Yeah, no, exactly. And they don't influence each other.
Yeah.
So let's just wrap this up, Mike. We'll just give a couple of summary points about inferential statistics. So the sole purpose of inferential statistics is to answer the single question. If there was no effect of a treatment and there was no substantial source of bias or confounding, how often would we see this result, or more extreme, by chance alone? I think we've talked about a statistically significant difference does not mean a medication or treatment worked. You have to look at a lot more. You have to look at the science around it. You've got to look to see what the study was like. You got to think about the size of the effect and all that sort of stuff. Another point is, I think we've talked about this, is a threshold for statistical significance should never be thought of as a dichotomous finding, a yes, no. And then the confidence interval is simply a range of values where we think the true value of the difference lies. I'm trying to think if there's anything else. The narrower the confidence interval, the higher the precision of the estimate. So the more likely, and when you study the entire population, you don't have a confidence interval because you know the answer. And then most importantly, is that you got to look at the relative number. And if it's a relative number, you got to apply it to the baseline risk so you get the absolute numbers. So those are the main key points. Anything else you want to add on that, Mike?
No, and I think you've made a good point about if you study the entire population, you don't need confidence intervals.
Yeah.
So your question was, at your high school, how many people in classroom A were female or male? Mm-hmm. That doesn't need a confidence interval because you're only looking at that group and you mm-hmm. count them up and that's the number. So it's
But if all we did was look at that one classroom and then we said, well,
this
how many
the school?
Yeah, then you do inferential.
Then you have to do statistics. But if you said how many people have, you know, red hair, how many people are above 5 feet tall, like those kind of things, you don't need it. If the question is referring to that population and you sampled everyone in the population.
Yeah.
It's only required if you're trying to infer something outside of that population. Yeah. That you're studying.
And so there's only one more thing I have to say about this is because I'm trying to prevent emails from people. And I'm talking about the people, and I don't mean this in a drug, who really like Bayesian statistics. Because I know a number of things that we've said, especially Mike, I said, are going to annoy people who
they annoy everyone. That's
fine. Yeah, I know, yeah. But Bayes statistics, even though you, I'm sure maybe some of you have heard of it, but what it is a way of looking at statistics, which describes the probability of an event occurrence based on previous knowledge of the condition. And there are ways of using a Bayes approach to the evaluation of clinical trials. I'll be honest with you. And now I'm going to get an email. I've never really found it that useful. Where I do find it very useful, and you know this as well as I do, Mike, when it comes to how do you use the results of a test when you're looking at sensitivity and specificity, if you've never heard of Bayesian, what that really, all Bayesian is what do you think the chance was that they had pneumonia in the first place? You did a test, and how much did it change that? Then I think Bayesian statistics, where you know the prior probability, is really useful for understanding things. I don't find it quite as useful for clinical trials. I don't know what you think, Mike.
I think that people who have any inquiries about this should definitely write
okay,
you.
Okay, there you go. Enough said. Point. Yeah. So we're not saying it's not useful. We're not saying it's not an approach that is important. It's just, I don't know if it adds all that much when you're looking at clinical trials. Anything else you want?
I think what you were saying is that you're useful and I'm not useful.
Yeah, I guess you could read that into that. At least there's a trend towards that.
That's a trend.
So anything else that you want to bring up about that, Mike?
No, that is good, James.
Yeah, so we've got our meme conference coming up in Vancouver. I think it's May 24th, 25th. So we would love it if you could attend that. And if that's it, we'll just leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.